Today is July 14th, 2021, and we are interviewing Dr. Andrew Badley for the Minnesota Pandemic Oral History Project. Dr. Badley is Professor of Medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases, Professor and Enterprise Chair of the Department of Molecular Medicine, and Chair of the COVID-19 Research Task Force at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. His research includes much work on HIV/AIDS and among many other areas of work, and includes conducting investigator-initiated clinical trials designed to complete the circle from bench to bedside. It has led to more than 180 peer-reviewed publications. He has also edited or co-edited 3 books and has written numerous book chapters. He's been appointed to many scientific advisory committees, including the NIH Director's Recombinant DNA Advisory Committee. He is a member of the American Society of Clinical Investigators, the Fellowship in the American College of Physicians, the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Canada, and Infectious Diseases Society of America. He has received many awards and much recognition for his work, and is the H.H. Sheikh Khalifa bin Zayed Al Nahyan named professor, Professorship of Infectious Diseases at the Mayo Clinic. In his appointment as chair of the Mayo Clinic Task Force on SARS-CoV-2 COVID-19, he oversees all research activities, including clinical trials related to the virus and disease. He recently was named Person of the Year by the Minnesota Business Magazine in recognition of this leadership role. Dr. Badley holds a BS and MD degrees from Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. He recently, after his degrees from Nova Scotia, he completed an internal medicine residency and clinician investigator training in infectious diseases at the Mayo Clinic. The interviewers are Barbara W. Summer and Adam Negri. So would you take us back to the beginning and tell us a little bit about what you thought might be coming and how you thought about approaching this disease that was heading our way?
So probably my first interaction with SARS-CoV-2 and the COVID disease happened around the time it happened for most people, which was December 2019. We heard of this outbreak. We heard stories about the severity of illness. And we've heard these stories before with diseases like hantavirus, chikungunya, and Ebola. And so the first thought that came to my mind is which of those phenotypes is going to manifest? Is it going to be a relatively mild illness? Is it going to be a severe illness with epidemic or even pandemic spread? But I wasn't thinking that at the beginning. And that was my initial thought. Very quickly, we started to see how it spread. So within days, cases started to pop up in other countries. And that was the red flag, if you will, that this is going to be something big, this is going to be something serious. I was thinking, as I'm sure many other infectious disease clinicians were thinking, that we would see some cases here at Mayo, I would be involved in the care of them, we'd probably approach them like we approached any virus for which we didn't have much experience, which was largely supportive care and try to manage people through the acute phase of illness and hopefully allow for most of them to recover. Then at Mayo Clinic, our CEO, Dr. Farrugia, called me one day and asked me to head the task force, and my thinking changed. But my thinking became, how do we respond in a comprehensive way to this pandemic? And given my background as a lab-based scientist and understanding that the reason that viruses cause disease is rarely the virus itself, but it's the host reaction to that virus. So immediately my mind started to think of, we need to study the virus, we need to study the host immune response to that virus, and we need to put together teams that treat the virus in a unbiased way. That was a little bit of a departure from how we operate as clinicians normally. Normally, as clinicians, somebody who is trained and who is expert in understanding a particular disease runs the care of a patient. But our initial premise was, nobody's expert at treating this because nobody's seen it before. And so rather than having the care of an individual patient managed by one person, what we decided to do was put together what we eventually called treatment review teams, which were a group of experts from multiple disciplines who were tasked with reviewing every patient who was in hospital every day, twice a day, to come to a consensus-based approach on how we manage that patient. As days and weeks went on, we began to understand that different organ systems could become involved. And so we asked other members to become part of the treatment review group. So eventually we had hematologists and kidney doctors and liver doctors and neurologists and infectious disease doctors and pulmonary critical care doctors. And I really think even to this day that putting together those treatment review teams was one of the most important things we did and led to our outcomes, which we believe are as good as anywhere in the world.
Were you just watching the disease, learning from the disease as it progressed, as you worked with the patients, looking at a disease that you hadn't seen before, or no one had seen before, essentially?
Absolutely. We were learning from each patient at the beginning. And very, very, very little was known. And so when we began to see abnormal clotting, a question arose, is this unrelated to the disease or is it a complication of the disease? And then when we started to see clusters of clots, we tasked our hematologists to dig in and learn more and see what was going on. And that led to the institution of guidelines and treatment approaches that were changed over time as we learned more, but to target the clots. And similarly with the kidney complications, and similarly with the liver complications. The next thing that occurred was multiple pharmaceutical companies and multiple scientists said, I know how to treat COVID, treat it with drug X. And very quickly, we had an onslaught of clinical research protocols that we had to decide between. And our response to that was, again, a departure from what was normally done. So the normal process here at Mayo is that a drug company will talk to a physician and that physician will make a decision and they'll start the clinical trial or not. What we decided to do is to have a coordinated approach to these clinical trials. We knew that we could not do every clinical trial that came across our plate. We wanted to do clinical trials that would have the most impact. And so we put together a team, and the team changed according to subject matter, that reviewed protocols to decide, is this impactful? Is this safe? Is this likely to make a meaningful difference in the care of our patients? And that was a paradigm shift for how we do things. We created some unhappy people, but our institution leadership was supportive of that approach. And ultimately, we, the task force, has reviewed somewhere well in excess of 800 different clinical trial protocols, and we've initiated maybe a few dozen. But we are proud of what we've done, because any drug that was eventually approved by the federal government under an EUA, we chose to study. And again, I referred to it earlier that our clinical outcomes are as good as anywhere. And I think that's a testament to both the coordinated approach to treatment with the treatment review groups and the process that we put in place for coordinating and prioritizing clinical trials.
Were you looking for specific types of drugs? In reading about some of the work that you had done, you had worked with convalescent plasma, I believe, and some of the others. But were you looking, and remdesivir came along, during this entire process. Were you looking at those, and were you looking at others? And how did you think that through to determine what you wanted to do?
What we did is we created a series of criteria by which we evaluated all the prospective drugs against. So if the drug was proposed was suggestive to block a virus and the SARS-CoV-2 virus from replicating, we wanted to see data that in the test tube, it blocked the virus from replicating. We wanted to see that this drug had already been in another human and was shown to be safe and well tolerated. And so we took the data that was presented and said, this is an insufficient package of information for us to approve it at this point. Please come back to us and show the test tube experiments that it blocks viral replication. Or please come back to us and show its safety paradigms. And sometimes companies did, and sometimes companies didn't, but that informed our decision. Similarly, for drugs that their proposed mechanism was to block some of the inflammatory mediators that occur following infection, we wanted to see if it blocks that inflammatory mediator, show us that that happens in an animal system or human system, and show us that in patients who are infected with SARS-CoV-2 and have COVID disease, that particular inflammatory mediator is elevated. And by keeping those criteria reasonably uniform across them, we could make a value-based prioritization between the different drugs. And many times our answer to companies was not no, it was no for now and come back with more information. And that self-selected those that did the sufficient due diligence to meet what we used as a threshold for starting those trials.
Well, did you find that the research that you were doing and that the work that you were doing, that the pandemic was having an impact on how you did things, on the directions that you took? It sounds as if you did in the way that you thought about research. Absolutely. And how to approach this very unusual situation.
Absolutely, it did. I think as a country, there were things that we could have done better. But I think overall, as a country, we did a lot of things well. One of the things we could have done better, in my opinion, was to create a coordination of clinical trials. So for various therapeutic candidates, and I'll pick one out of the air, hydroxychloroquine. There was well in excess of 25 or 30 different clinical trials on hydroxychloroquine. And in retrospect, that was not a service to anyone. That meant that the trials competed against each other. Very few of them were completed successfully. Very few of them led to any actionable results. And there was a lot of controversy around them. But because of that knowledge, many of our investigators here at Mayo were approached by each of those 25 different trials. And so if we were doing one, we sure as heck weren't going to do another. Similarly, within a therapeutic class, there were a large group of drugs that their mechanism of action is to block the effects of a cytokine called IL-6. And so there were antibodies that blocked IL-6. There were antibodies that blocked IL-6 receptors. And similarly, once we were doing a trial of one class of drugs, we weren't going to do another trial of another member of the same class. We wanted to get the information from that first trial. Is there biologic plausibility and a initial signal of therapeutic efficacy before we would put any other patients to at least a degree of risk by exposing them to that same therapeutic class?
Well, I'm glad you brought up competition. It sounds as if there was a certain amount of competition going on. There may have also been parallel work that was being done across the country. How did that affect the work that you were doing, since you were had a good broad approach to doing this work?
So I think the first part of my answer will be tangential, but I promise to come back to a point. So
okay.
One of the inspiring parts of SARS-CoV-2 was that virtually every group that was doing something to tackle SARS-CoV-2 broke down a lot of barriers of information ownership and of intellectual property, so that I could get on the phone and call my colleagues at Duke or Mass General or San Francisco and say, we're considering drug X. We haven't made a decision yet. We know you're doing a trial on it. Tell us your experience. And that helped us to prioritize all of our drugs, including those drugs for which there were parallel efforts around the place. And that was very, very refreshing, as opposed to the normal way of conducting business.
And there were competitive as well, as you said, there were some that were competitive. So it was an interesting climate that year. Things must have been moving pretty fast.
Oh, very much.
Moving really fast.
Remarkably fast.
And changing constantly.
And changing constantly.
Yeah.
And, you know, we now live in an era, as you're well aware, of 24/7 news services, all of whom wanted to create the latest scoop on the latest treatment, advance or failure. And so on a daily basis, there were news reports that this drug worked or that drug didn't work, or you're crazy to try this, and so we were spending a lot of our time being responsive to those reports, and our treatment teams we'd do the treatment review team, we'd say, let's approach Mrs. X with a drug candidate. Often our study coordinators who'd approach that family, they'd be met with, I just heard on the news that this drug is no good, which I've never seen in my life before. And thankfully we don't see it much anymore now, a year and a half into it. But that was remarkable. It was truly remarkable. And I do think that need for sensational news has negatively impacted the care of some patients.
How did you handle that?
I didn't, because I was not the ones approaching the patients.
Yeah. How did the...
But the teams did,
yeah,
by trying to represent the truthful, objective facts surrounding the drug. And you know, many of the news reports were anecdotal at best. And you know, at the end of the day, it's up to the patient and or the patient's family to decide whether or not they want to be enrolled in a clinical trial. And it's their decision, and we can't overstep that. But what we can do is to help provide information.
Adam, did you have a
Yeah, I was hoping we could turn back just for a second to these treatment review teams and maybe a glimpse at the timeline kind of behind the scenes at how these were working. You mentioned organs would fail, you'd bring in specialists, either it'd be blood clots, you'd bring in hematologists. What kind of a timeline were you working on? Maybe whether it was day to day or the week, and a follow-up to that would be, could you just describe a day overseeing these teams and what that looked like? Because this does seem like a special, this consensus-based approach does seem like a special way, a unique way of approaching the pandemic.
that we were responding hour to hour. A typical day in the life of the treatment review team, we had one clinician who led the team every day, and that clinician would show up to work somewhere between 5 and 6 o'clock in the morning, review the patients who were in hospital on that day quickly, just by electronic means. And at 8:30 we'd have our call. And at 8:30 we'd go through every patient. Patients who were on a treatment and stable got maybe a minute of conversation. Patients who were new and or not stable got a lot more, sometimes half an hour. And a consensus-based approach was, what's wrong with them? Do we know it's COVID? Have we ruled out other things? If it's not COVID, what do we do? If it is COVID, what are our treatment options? Given this patient's comorbidities and complications and other drugs, what can we offer to that person with weigh-in from all the teams that are relevant? And when we'd see a blood clot, we'd say, Dr. Hematologist, please look at it and understand it and give us a recommendation. And if they could on the call, they would. If they couldn't, they'd go and see the patient face to face as soon as we hung up the phone and get back to us by email. And so between the time that call ended, which was 10 o'clock or so, people would go and see the patients and do the day-to-day work of taking care of patients, and then we'd get on the call again at 2 o'clock. And if there was no change in individual patients, that was the sum total of their conversation, no change in Mrs. Jones. But if there was a change, then we put that same level of scrutiny in. And overnight, as new admissions came, the clinician who was treating the patients would send an email to everyone on the treatment review team, and those who were available to discuss would discuss. And we'd repeat again the next day. And that occurred for a year. And so really the unsung heroes, I think, are those teams who were working 24/7 for a year. It was remarkable.
It sounds as if, too, as if what you're saying is that you were taking the work of the task force from the research and moving it into patient care, that there that that
100%. And that was iterative. Every day we got new research understanding or finding, and every day that evolved how we approach patients.
So you were going from bench to bed and making that connection that.
Absolutely. And the people who work at Mayo tend to have pretty broad connections elsewhere. And so people would bring what they learned from their friends and what they learned from their societies and what nuances and treatment they had available. And it was common once or twice a week, maybe we'd spend the first 5 or 10 minutes of the treatment review calls updating each other on data that we'd learned.
Yeah, so you were keeping that those lines of communication going. Adam, did you have another question you wanted to ask right
Yeah,
now?
just a quick follow-up. Could you say a bit about in you got the call from the CEO and forming this team and this collaborative consensus-based approach. Was there a framework or experiences that you relied on in helping guide that process, or was it really day to day, hour to hour? Like, was there a handbook, right?
Well, so there's no handbook, and to be perfectly honest, day one I was reactive. What do we do to take care of the needs that we have today? But a week or so into it, maybe 2 weeks into it, I was able to take stock of what we had and what we needed. And ultimately, we put together work streams that were populated by subject matter experts that reported up to the task force. And at the end of the day, we had 23 different work streams that covered, to be honest, everything I can think of that's relevant to SARS-CoV-2. So we had groups that studied the virus. We had groups that studied the immunology. We had groups that studied healthcare disparities and how we can impact that. We had groups that were focused on specimen collection so we can create a biobank, so we can give samples to our researchers. We had groups that were focused on what vaccines are out there and when will they roll out and how do we deliver them. We had groups on maternal fetal health. Is SARS-CoV-2 infection of a mother bad for the child? If so, what should we do? Groups on pediatrics, critical care, rollout of emergency use drugs, everything we could think of.
That was pretty thorough, obviously. One of the questions that's come up, or one of the lines of discussion that's come up in these interviews, has to do with what's called the twin pandemics in Minnesota, the effect of the systemic racism, the impact of the George Floyd killing or murder. I know you're in Rochester, we'll say southeastern Minnesota for those who might be listening to this interview many years from now or whenever it is. So you're outside the Twin Cities, which was the focus of all of this. But what impact did that have on your work? Or talk a little bit about that, please.
So it was profound. So I began my career in HIV, mm-hmm. and healthcare disparities have been a longstanding problem in the HIV world. Nowhere near as acute as in the SARS-CoV-2 world. There was a family that we took care of that profoundly impacted me, and I assume my other task force members. And it was a migratory farm worker family who didn't have the option to work remotely, lived in a small family dwelling with a couple other families, so very, very close proximity. When one family member got it, they all got it. They were undocumented, so they were unwilling to seek healthcare early. They were uninsured, so they couldn't pay for healthcare even if they did. And they all presented to healthcare at a late stage of advanced disease. They all went into the ICU, and many of them had very bad outcomes. And to me, that was absolutely illustrative of how healthcare disparities caused excess morbidity and mortality in this pandemic. One of the things I'm doing this week is I am on calls with multiple congressional offices about lessons learned from the pandemic. And that is one of the lessons that I have been telling them all, is that, you know, at steady state, ideally, but at a minimum, at pandemic times, we need to break down these barriers to access to healthcare, because people are dying because of it.
Yeah, I know. Did you find that and I know you've done a great deal of work with the HIV/AIDS and research with HIV/AIDS. Did you find, as you started to think about this pandemic or look at this pandemic, that there were lessons learned, and you said you just described one, but other lessons learned that you could carry forward?
Absolutely.
Experience that you had with HIV/AIDS that you could carry forward to this pandemic? What were they? What were some of the others?
So on a scientific level, we knew how to diagnose the virus. It was a different virus, but the same diagnosis. It was a PCR-based strategy to begin with. We knew from HIV that more virus is bad and less virus is good. So we could modify our treatments to that. We knew that it's the host response to the virus that kills people. It's not the virus itself. So we could think along those lines. We knew that a good strategy to interrupt the disease caused by a virus is to block the virus replication. So one of the first drugs that we used in HIV was block virus replication was ACT. The first drug we used for SARS-CoV-2 was remdesivir, and it worked. We've had decades and decades of sustained biomedical funding towards HIV and AIDS, and some of those strategies did not work for HIV and AIDS, and I'm referring now to some of the vaccine-based approaches. But because of those, we knew they were safe and well tolerated and didn't pose a big risk. So those platforms were repurposed towards SARS-CoV-2. And we as society and mankind is incredibly lucky that SARS-CoV-2 can be prevented very, very effectively, in fact, remarkably effectively by vaccination. But all of those tools and skills were informed by the work we the scientific community has done for the past 40 years of HIV. And it is 40 years, which is remarkable.
It is remarkable. It's been that long, at least in Minnesota. Well, even before that, on the coasts, and then traveled to the middle of the country and to Minnesota. But so in that sense, you were able to carry forward. You said scientifically you were able to carry forward. And also, I would expect, just in terms of understanding needs of the population or unique needs of the populations, because that too was a characteristic of the HIV/AIDS
Absolutely epidemic. Right. I think time will reflect that the thought leaders in SARS-CoV-2 are not uniquely, but dominantly the thought leaders from HIV.
That's an interesting parallel to make. What about some of the other epidemics? Were they as influential? Do you think Ebola or some of the others that, you know, come along since then?
Yeah. So as influential, probably not, only because they were not as sustained and consequently not as heavily funded. but even those, I mean, the approach to Ebola was the same approach as to HIV and is the same approach as SARS-CoV-2 in terms of the vaccination strategy. Right? So they're all huge parallels.
So there are parallels of building knowledge or at least drawing on a knowledge base of some of what you can.
The other analogy I've made many times is if you go back to think 40 years ago with HIV, it took us better part of a decade to identify the virus, know what it did, understand its biology, come up with a diagnostic, come up with a so-so drug. That took a decade. But because of that sustained biomedical funding that I referred to earlier, all three of those steps were accomplished in about 4 months for SARS-CoV-2, which is remarkable. It's remarkable. I don't think our response to SARS-CoV-2 could have been as effective even 10 years ago.
Were you expecting that? Did you have any sense that that might be the case as you were looking at this early on and trying to think it through?
I don't know if in those days I spent any nickel's worth of time thinking about how well we'd do. I mean, it was a busy time. I spent a lot of time looking at protocols and creating strategies and planning and taking care of patients. I didn't didn't put a lot of thought into how successful would we be, how quickly.
In
retrospect, I'm amazed. I'm absolutely amazed. And I frequently think to myself or comment to others how lucky we are that the vaccine is so effective.
Yeah, we are.
I mean, if you had said at the beginning that any one of these vaccines would be 90%+ effective at preventing severe disease, hospitalization, and death, I don't think there's a single person who would have agreed with you.
I don't know that there would have been. And there was so much confusion and concern early on. I remember questions, there was a letter sent by of infectious disease specialists, a public letter from infectious disease specialists in Minnesota and I think Iowa in late October or November saying, be careful, do this right. It was a difficult time and there were so many questions. Do you want to talk a little bit about the development of the vaccine and also the bioethics? And I want to get a question on bioethics involved, but let's talk about the development. What are your thoughts about the development of that vaccine, besides moving fast?
So it's not a revolutionary approach in my mind. Let's take a step back and talk about the activity of vaccines for viral infections. For hundreds of years, we've been using vaccines for viral infections. As time has gone on, we've become more sophisticated in it, but the concept is the same. And that is that you take the outer part of the virus and you make a vaccine out of it, and you hope that antibodies raised against that outer part of the virus will block entry and infection. And over years, we've done it for lots of different viruses. And for polio, it works beautifully. For HIV or hepatitis C, it doesn't work at all. But for most infections, it works somewhere in between. And, common example would be influenza. Influenza, it's 60-70% effective. And that degree of effectiveness is enough to reduce the burden of disease on a planetary level. And what we did for SARS-CoV-2 is conceptually the same. We used a few different tools to do it. And by and large, we used vaccine platforms that were already out there. And it's not a lot of work for anybody who works in a lab to clone in a new gene into a new vector. That's done in my lab every day, hopefully every day. So it's not an intellectual leap of faith. The trials were done quickly, but the parts that were not expedited was the parts that involved the patients. The parts that were expedited were the regulatory review, the FDA review, the approvals within the institution and the IRB. So I have said publicly, and I'll say publicly again today, there were no shortcuts taken with these. And so I think the vaccine rollout was appropriate and efficient. I expect to see more vaccine studies in the SARS-CoV-2 space soon, possibly very soon. For example, looking at different vaccine platforms for people who have weakened immune systems. That study needs to be done. We will start to see trials of a booster vaccine to see if you can prolong duration of immunity. We haven't yet reached the end of immune protection from the first series of vaccines, but those studies will start as well. And I am hopeful and I have every reason to suspect that the same care and control of the trials will occur for those future vaccine studies as has happened for the first iteration of vaccine studies for SARS-CoV-2.
Well, and children are not, children under age 12, I believe, are not, the vaccine, there isn't a vaccine that is, has been approved for that age group yet.
They have not yet received an EUA, but those trials are ongoing.
So that too.
So if, you know, the idea being here that we're creating like a primary source, right, that goes in the archives and people might look at this in the future to help understand these events. Do you have anything to say? You've touched on the news, right? This kind of unprecedented sensationalist aspect of the news that seemed to directly affect your distribution of healthcare. How might people in the future look at vaccine distribution in the last, you know, 7 or so months? How can you help them understand like how that has played out?
I tend to avoid political statements because frankly they don't interest me that much. But for reasons that partially relate to the news and partially relate to other factors, the response of the public to the vaccine has been divided amongst political lines. And that is stunningly unfortunate. Today, July 14, 2021, we are seeing a increase in resurgence of cases that occurs almost exclusively in those who are unvaccinated. And by almost exclusively, I mean greater than 95%. So it's pretty concordant. And the bulk of those uptick in cases occur in regions where the society has had poor vaccine uptake. The anecdote I heard yesterday was in regions of Missouri where the population-based uptake of vaccines is less than 50%. I don't know the numbers for Minnesota. I probably should, but they are much higher than 50%.
They are, yeah.
And so it is unfortunate that the politicization has led to individuals getting their healthcare advice from politicians. It's unfortunate. And I don't know what the solution is, but I do know that it's a problem that the media has become a primary source of healthcare information for many people, and that the information that is being delivered differs according to what party you affiliate with. What news network you affiliate with. And I would love to see some process put in place that does not and cannot happen again. And that the source of healthcare information reverts to what it has been and should be, which is healthcare information is received from your treating physician.
What about the public health messages? Because you can have, and we do have, good science. We know it's good science, but the public health, how do we translate that to an effective, maybe, public health message that can help override or that can help maybe pull people together? And I know we've had people in these interviews say they're very surprised that the country just did not come together to fight this, but it didn't, and that's the reality. So, you know, is there a model for that? Is there a way to think about that?
Yeah, so there's no question that there needs to be an aligned public health response. The public health system in the States, I think, was stressed by SARS-CoV-2 for multiple reasons. One is that it's underfunded and understaffed. And so things like testing when it became necessary and the rollout of testing was challenged. The contact tracing was challenged, didn't have enough people to do that. Rollout of experimental drugs that had just received emergency use authorization that was put on the shoulders of the public health departments. And whereas in non-pandemic times, public health is mostly an oversight activity, during SARS-CoV-2, it was asked to take on an execution role as well. And that stressed it. And I think there's a lot of lessons that can be learned there. I think we need to come together and have a process by which best practices can be identified and shared. And there can be a alignment of how these activities are done between different states based upon the experience of everyone.
Well, and that brings up the other situation too, and that is that each state was a bit on its own.
It was very much on their own.
Yeah.
Mayo Clinic has footprints in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Arizona, and Florida. We got to live it firsthand that when a drug was being rolled out and we wanted to get a drug for a patient, the process would differ according to what state we were in. And I think most would agree that's not ideal.
No, and someone, I think there was a description that Minnesota was a little island in some ways, of a certain kind, you know, of leadership in terms of giving us directives on spacing, you know, wearing masks, all the safety features. And that didn't always hold true in neighboring states. That Minnesota, it was a hard role to play, maybe.
It was. Now, I will say that the intentions and hearts and minds of leadership in public health, and those are the people in public health I interacted with, they were in the right place. They were absolutely in the right place. I think after any of us organize a large undertaking such as what they undertook, there are things you would have done differently in retrospect. But I think by and large, they've done a good job.
Hard work on everyone's part. Adam, did you have any questions about, I want to go to, or about bioethics, or I will quick put one in, but, or another, any others?
Yeah. Kind of going back to some of the tools and networks you had, we read a bit about Mayo's use of AI, especially concerning like real-time tracking. And I wanted to make sure that we have you here to ask you a bit about that, because it does seem like it's new. I'm, you know, in the broad scheme, but also looking forward, you know, is that with us to stay? And, you know, if lessons learned, and if you could just say a bit about that.
Absolutely. So we did use artificial intelligence to help inform and predict where outbreaks would occur. And based upon that informing, we could selectively remobilize resources at the early phase of the epidemic to enhance density of testing in those areas where we thought were going to be a hotspot. That, I think, was wildly successful. If you look at the PCR positivity rates and their trajectory before reallocating resources and how that changed after we reallocated resources, oftentimes that reallocation resulted in an inflection point and the PCR positivity rate went down. So I think that's evidence that it was successful. We've used those same computer-based skills to analyze countless number of scenarios that have occurred since then. One that comes to mind because it was recent was, we have all heard reports about cavernous sinus thrombosis occurring after particularly young women receive the J&J vaccine. And that those are facts. You can't argue that they had that complication, and you can't argue that it occurred after the J&J vaccine. What you can argue is there a change in incidence of that occurring because of the J&J vaccine? So we used our computer-based technologies and teams that can delve into this and looked at the frequency of cavernous sinus thrombosis occurring 30 days before receiving the J&J vaccine versus 30 days after, and the incidence is identical. And then we looked at the incidence occurring 30 days before a flu vaccine throughout history at Mayo Clinic versus 30 days after a flu vaccine, and the incidence is identical. So while there are these reports of cavernous sinus thrombosis, which is true, this is another topic where perhaps the message has been sensationalized. And so while it's true they occurred, their incidence is no different before or after J&J, and no different to a different, totally unrelated vaccine. So those kinds of analytics allow us to inform our policies and inform our patients and share objective data on the risk associated with this vaccine, which is a very effective vaccine.
And it sounds like this is going to be a permanent facet of the biomedical landscape moving forward. I mean, would that be your assessment?
Not going away anytime soon. And the other part, as we're talking about essentially digital technologies right now, is this was a shot of adrenaline in the development of other digital technologies in healthcare. So one are digital visits. Patients appropriately did not want to come to a hospital that was full of COVID patients. So people began to seek their healthcare through digital platforms or remotely. And there were growing pains, but now it is a totally embedded part of our practice. And many patients prefer it for some part of their care. For example, if they're coming to Mayo to say, do I need an operation for disease X? That can be done on a computer Zoom with the records being shared digitally, and a surgeon can review and provide an opinion. And that can be done remotely. And if the conclusion is, yes, you need a surgery, then you fly into town just for that surgery part. Another example is analytics of remote physiologic monitoring. And the one that Mayo is most involved in, but it's not exclusively the only one we're involved with, is analyzing electrocardiograms, so heart rhythms that can be taken off a smartphone. So there is an app you can get where you click a little button on your wrist or on your chest, and your app phone, your iPhone will read your electrocardiogram. Information from that electrocardiogram can inform you, what is your physiologic age of your heart? Do you have an abnormal heart rhythm? Do you have pulmonary hypertension? Do you have COVID? So there are signals that you can see in that electrocardiogram that will give you a probability of having COVID. And it's most useful to rule out COVID, but that in and of itself is a very important finding. And so that era of remote physiologic monitoring is really in its infancy, but COVID really sped it up incredibly.
Fascinating. We have just a couple minutes left with you. I'd like to ask, if we could, a little bit about the impact of bioethics and the concepts of bioethics on the work that's been done during the pandemic. And I did a number of, 4 or 5 years ago, a team of us did a number of interviews looking at HIV/AIDS healthcare in Minnesota. I went back and reviewed some of that stuff, and I don't remember seeing the word or hearing a lot about bioethics, but it's become quite something that's much more it's become a stronger voice now, I would think. And would you comment on that? And that will be our last question.
Yeah, so our bioethicists have been heavily involved in all of this from day one, from composition of the treatment review teams. Is it what are the ethical implications of taking care out of the hands of one person and putting it into a team? To where do we initiate clinical trials? If we initiate a clinical trial in Rochester but don't initiate it in Arizona, what are the ethical considerations there? Very quickly, we came across unpredicted questions that are difficult to answer, like somebody just died of COVID. Can you use their kidneys in organ transplantation? Questions of vaccination. Many groups are now struggling with, should we mandate vaccination for our patients, our staff, those staff that see patients on a day-to-day basis? All of these have profound ethical considerations, and we have engaged our ethicists liberally and asked them to provide an opinion and an ethical framework with which to consider our decisions on any of those topics and others. For example, what are the inclusion criteria by which we can offer outpatient monoclonal antibodies? You can't open them up to everyone. There's not enough supply. So how do you prioritize? So very heavily involved with our biomedical ethicists. And in fact, and this is a testament to the job that the State Health Department did, they convened a panel of biomedical ethicists to help inform all of their treatment panels. So there was a treatment panel on how to use remdesivir, and ethicists informed that. So more than I've ever seen before, ethics was integral to our entire response, and in fact, the state's entire response.
So that again, that's another as a change we see in the development coming about because of the pandemic. And you've mentioned several during this interview, where we're seeing this coming to the fore, as it were, or pushed to the fore maybe by the pandemic. Well, thank you. That's at the end of an hour. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we sign off?
No,
that we haven't covered.
No, I think you've been very broad and diverse. And it was fun.
We really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Yep. Bye-bye.